8 just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg. Let's check WGTD sports and weather. Major League Baseball, the Brewers continue on their roll. They beat Colorado 5-2. Cubs and White Sox were off. Tonight, the Brewers play the Rockies again in Denver. And weather permitting this afternoon, the White Sox and the Cubs at Wrigley. Now that WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Friday, May 11th. Cloudy and quite cool, light rain off and on throughout the day, a high of 47. Rain tonight, a low of 45. 50-50 chance of rain tomorrow, a high of 52. Right now, it's cooled off quite a bit. Wind from the northeast at 10. It's raining, 41 in Kenosha, 38 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg. Well, originally scheduled today was going to be a brand new interview recorded with one of America's finest comedians, Paula Poundstone. Unfortunately, she had to cancel her media tour at the last moment, and that interview could not be recorded. Well, I needed to be able to fill in the void with something extra special, and what I've chosen to do is replay for you a portion of a very memorable conversation that I recorded back in 2005 with none other than Alan Alda, much heralded for his great work on the television series MASH and in a number of other ventures as well. Winner of many, many different awards, very, very highly regarded in the industry, and a very talented author as well. The occasion of our conversation back in 2005 was the publication of his memoir called Never Have Your Dog Stuffed and Other Things I've Learned. I spoke with Alan Alda just before he was scheduled to pay a visit to Alverno College in Milwaukee to speak about his memoir and about his very, very memorable life. So here is a portion of my conversation with Alan Alda.
I want to jump to the afterword of the book before we start talking about some of the great stories you tell in Never Have Your Dog Stuffed.
The book has new material in it, so not only is it cheaper, it's longer.
Very good. One of the things you mentioned there, which I think is quite interesting, is you say most authors seem to hate going around the country talking about their books. You say, I loved it. I went everywhere I could, and as the writer Alexander King used to say, I covered America with the slime of my amiability. Tell us why you think this experience of not only of writing the book itself, but then of wanting to share it with the public as you did, why you think that was so, and what exactly gave you so much pleasure?
Well, a couple of things. One is, as you know from reading the book, I've wanted to be as good a writer as I could be since I was 8 years old. So, I mean, I really wanted to be a writer before I wanted to be an actor. So I've written a lot. It's mostly dramatic stuff I've written, movies and television shows. But I never wrote a book before, and I wanted this to be accept it as a piece of writing and not as a bunch of revelations about a celebrity. And there really aren't any revelations in. People should know if they're reading it for, if they're getting it for that, they're not going to, that's not going to be in it. I hoped to write an interesting story and a funny one. And so to have that accepted that way made me really delighted. But then there was this other thing. I'm a performer. So when I get up and talk about the book, it's like doing a show for me. And I love it. I love to go to a bookstore or an auditorium. And for an hour, I'm performing in a way, but with material that I really know well, because not only did I write it, but I lived it.
Hmm. Well, I guess that makes you different from maybe certain other writers who might be quite solitary, shy creatures, because you don't have to be anything like an actor or a performer of any kind to be a great writer. But if you happen to be both those things, then that gets to be a wonderful combination when it comes to talking about the book.
Yeah, it gives you a chance to perform if you like that sort of thing. I actually, some of this book started out that way. About 10 years ago, I wanted to have a piece that I could get up and perform if I, you know, whenever I felt like performing, and I wrote a one-man show called Never Have Your Dog Stuffed with a lot of the material that wound up in the book. But I wound up only doing it once or twice, but it stayed in the background, and I kept thinking about it. And when the time finally came, after this thing happened to me in Chile, where I nearly died a couple of years ago, I found myself going back over my life and thinking about how I had lived, what had sort of made me who I was up until Chile, and I started writing it down, because I was looking for what there was in that would give me some clue about how I could make the most out of this new time that I had been given, this gift of another life.
This new Eden, as you called it.
Yeah, because I was within a couple of hours of checking out in Chile, and I was in a small town that happened to have this expert surgeon in it, and he diagnosed me correctly and took out about a yard of dead intestine that would have, really could have been the end of me. Mm-hmm.
I remember at one point in the book, you are having an experience with your mother. And we'll talk about this in a moment, the fact that your mother battled increasingly serious mental illness for most of her life and just about all of your life.
Yeah.
There was one experience that occurred, I think this might have been when all of you were in Europe, and she suffered some kind of breakdown, and maybe it's you and your father are trying to wrestle her to the car, I'm trying to remember, but you're honest enough to tell us that in the middle of that really dramatic experience, it occurs to you, this really belongs in my life story. I mean, someday when I write a book, I got to remember to tell this story.
I didn't know if it would be a book. I didn't know. I think at that point, I was only 18. At that point, I didn't think I'd be writing my life story ever. But I knew I wanted to be a writer, and I was always trying to learn how to write. And it's an interesting thing, I think. This probably happens to all writers and probably actors, all actors. When you go through something really intense, like an experience that you know is the deepest kind of experience anybody can go through. While you're going through it, you're totally involved in it, but some other part of your brain is saying, remember this, that you can use this. This is an important human experience. You got to remember the details of this so that you can make it live in somebody else's imagination. I mean, you just can't help doing that.
Hmm. You, of course, hosted this PBS Science series for quite a number of years. And one of those programs was about memory.
Yeah.
And you talk in the book about kind of the disconcerting experience of undergoing, I guess it would amount to sort of an experiment or a demonstration, which very clearly showed your memory was not as impregnable as you assumed, or most of us assume about our own memories.
I think, not only do we all feel from time to time, no, I remember exactly what happened, and I'll tell you what happened. We even accept that idea in courts of law, where we have eyewitness testimony that's supposed to be impregnable. Well, this guy, this psychiatrist, he's a memory researcher, his name is Schachter at Harvard, he made me remember things that I had never seen. I had seen them, but I thought I had seen them in real life, and I had only seen them in pictures. And I couldn't tell the difference between the pictures and the real event that I had witnessed.
Hmm.
And well, so you can put memories in people's minds in various ways like that.
Well, and of course, it makes you wonder, as it makes us wonder, too, about when we believe that we're remembering things from a long time ago. You say at one point, I'd always been surprised at how far back my memories go and the detailed scenes I'd been able to call up. I felt I had the raw material for understanding my beginnings, but now I began to wonder.
Right, because he said to me while we were walking in the park in Boston, you know, memory is not a very good basis for autobiography.
Mm.
So, I mean, I put that in because I want to be straight about it all. I'm remembering it to the best of my ability. But I also know, especially based on what, pardon me, I also know, especially based on what Schachter told me, that you, every time you remember something, you change it a little bit partly by the circumstances under which you remember it, the things you're feeling or thinking about then, and your feelings, your emotions, according to another memory expert I talked to. Those feelings, those any emotions, make you remember things. And when you recall something in a certain emotional state, you're probably changing the memory by virtue of the state you're in now. And after a while, I think what's happening is we're remembering memories of other memories of other memories and so on, so that it starts to be like the dog in the title, Never Have Your Dog Stuffed. You know, one of the things in this afterword that you mentioned I tell in there about how this amazing thing happened to me after going around the country talking about my poor dog who died and how we had him stuffed, hoping to keep the memory of the dog alive. And then he came back from the taxidermist looking hideously unlike the real dog. And, well, what happened was that after talking about that and thinking about it so much and it being a kind of a mantra for my life, you know, don't stuff your dog. Let change happen. This is what I think I've learned. Well, now I'm sitting in a bookstore signing books. This is about a year ago. And a woman comes up to me and says, I'm your fourth cousin, and I have some pictures to give you, from the family pictures. And I open the envelope, and the first picture is a picture of my father with his arms around the dog, my dog, Rhapsody, the one that I loved. And it doesn't look anything like how I remembered him, because the stuffed dog had completely replaced in my mind the image of the real dog. So it was like a perfect example of what's wrong with stuffing the dog. It's this, the stuffed dog had become a memory of the memory of the memory. The picture itself was a kind of stuffed dog because it wasn't the real dog. It was just a flat representation.
Right.
But
so,
my God, it was so much better. It was so much closer to the real dog.
As I looked at the yellowed photo, the two images jumped back and forth in my head, the caricature of a stuffed dog and the vague memory of the living animal as if they were vying for dominance. This is your dog, one said. No, this is your dog, said the other. I was holding in my hand the sad proof of how a memory can be completely erased and replaced by another.
Right.
We're speaking with Alan Alda. We're talking about his memoir. It is called Never Have Your Dog Stuffed and Other Things I've Learned. One thing that people talk about so much is the very first sentence of this book. You want to tell our listeners what that first sentence is, first of all?
My mother didn't try to stab my father until I was six.
And I wonder, this is obviously a very direct reference to the fact that your mother was very troubled. I wonder what went through your mind in making the decision to open your book exactly this way in such stark fashion?
Well, it actually was a later chapter in the book that I knew that I wanted to open the chapter that way because it was I wanted to get the reader's attention and also to you know the sentence has a couple of reverberations in it. It kind of reflects the fact that it was just a part of my life. It wasn't some melodramatic moment. I was a little boy who saw my mother go toward my father with a knife in fury, and it was something I had to cope with. And the kind of casual nature of that sentence, it carries that feeling, along with the harsh notion that it is actually a knife, and she's your mother, and he's your father. But the reason it's in the beginning of the book is that my editor was very sharp and said, you know, that's such a strong beginning. Why don't you make that the first thing they read? And, of course, he was right.
Although I think you talk in the afterword about how one of your, maybe your nieces or a granddaughter or something.
Yeah, my granddaughter, who was eight, she picked up the book. It was laying on a table in her house, and she just opened it because she was curious. She saw my picture on the cover, and she opened the book, and she read, My mother didn't stab my father until I was, she said, well, that's weird, and she closed the book and never looked at it again.
Well, I trust most readers have exactly the opposite experience, and it makes them want to probe more
deeply. Well, I hope most
deeper.
Of the readers are older than eight.
Yep, right. Your mother, of course, did indeed suffer from a mental illness, and it worsened over time, and she and all of you were probably, in a sense, lucky to survive it. One of the most poignant things, I think, in the entire book is when you talk about how this subject was completely avoided by you and your father, and I suppose, really, and your mother, too. I mean,
yeah.
This was something never, ever talked about.
It's hard to believe now. We all live in a much more open culture, and, I mean, people go on television and talk about their sex lives and their the most intimate facts of their existence, and it's hard for people now to believe that there was a time when, if there was mental illness in the family, for almost everybody in the country, you simply didn't talk about it because it brought shame to the family. Nobody knew where it came from, and there was a kind of fear of talking about it. But it's even more amazing to me to think that there were only three of us in the family. I was an only child, and my mother's behavior was, it wasn't, you know, it was truly psychotic. She was, she thought we were trying to kill her. She would turn over the furniture. She threw her wedding ring off the balcony. She was totally out of control a good deal of the time. Now, you would think that the two other people in that triad would discuss it and try to figure out a strategy, how to deal with it. We never mentioned it.
Well, and it's so, you're so perceptive, I think, in talking about the consequences of that beyond just the how nice it would have been on sort of an emotional level to share this. But you say how much easier it could have been for my father and me to face her illness together, to compare notes, to figure out strategies.
Yeah.
Instead, each of us was on his own. I mean,
yeah.
That, in many respects, was the highest cost of that.
Yeah, I think so. And it didn't give us a chance to get together as collaborators. My father and I, we didn't get together in an easy relationship for a long time. I mean, I was an adult before we did. And I in a way, you know, in my childish innocence, sometimes I blamed him for her behavior. You know, I mean, I didn't know. I blamed myself. I thought I brought it on. I didn't know where it came from. So there's, I think, a really strong benefit that comes to us now from talking more. You know, it's a cliche to say you want to talk about it. You know, but it actually does help people to share this information, to share feelings of doubt or feelings of vulnerability, because you realize the other person may be going through the same thing, and it can be supportive.
Sure. Well, and plus just the whole idea of, did you see her do that? I mean, when I said this, she did this. And
right.
I mean, just that sort of comparing notes thing that you mentioned. I mean, on a very practical sort of level, it would have been, I mean, one presumes, so much more helpful.
And by the way, that's really a good point. It really is a practical issue. Compassion helps a little bit in that it keeps you from unnecessarily getting angry at this erratic behavior. But the compassion's not going to halt the erratic behavior. It's really how you can handle your end of it and not suffer unnecessarily. But you really have to work around this irrational stuff that's coming at you.
Your mother and father were part of, I was going to say vaudeville, it was actually burlesque.
Yes.
A little.
Quite very different.
Yeah,
a lot of people now don't know the difference.
Right, but yeah, kind of a dirtier, grimier sort of thing.
Yeah.
And here you are, a youngster. You talk often about standing in the wings, watching.
Yeah.
And some of what you experienced obviously had ramifications deep into your life and far into the future. What do you think was most valuable about what you witnessed on and off the stage in those years?
You know, I probably can't evaluate what was good for me or bad for me standing in the wings watching burlesque, because again, it was just my life. It's what I did. I do know that some of the most valuable things were watching performers and actors to see how they did what they did, to watch them from the side. Not watching from the front, from the audience point of view, you're getting the illusion that they're creating. When you stand in the wings and watch from the side, you're watching them create the illusion, and you see a lot more of what goes into it.
Hmm.
And you're much closer to them. You're only a couple of feet away. And all of that energy that goes between the actors and goes between the actors and the audience is something you can really track. You can see where it comes from. You can see the difference between who they are as people and who they are as the characters, and a lot of stuff like that. But who knows what benefits or not lurk in me from watching all those naked ladies and watching erotic dancing and that kind of thing.
And the relationship was obviously an interesting one. You said that for them you were almost like a pet or even a plaything. You use both of those terms to, I mean, what an odd role you were playing in this.
Well, you know, actors like children. They love children because they make a good audience. They like to perform for them and get a happy reaction from them. And the chorus girls were all women and all mothering, you know, so they mothered me a lot.
But I
actually don't remember where my real mother was a lot of the time.
Hmm.
I was in the chorus girls' dressing rooms a lot, and I don't know where my mother was at that time.
You also...
By the way, she did love me very much, and I benefited from that a lot. That was an interesting side dish to her psychosis, was that in spite of that she loved me. She gave me a lot of support through that love.
Hmm. This group with which you spent so much of your time, one of the things you say now in retrospect is you're struck by how you grew up among people who didn't seem to know what children were because they were children themselves.
Yes,
and you say you couldn't tell the difference really either, so you were just sort of one big happy troupe, and you could really be part of that, and were part of that in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, they did understand that I was a lot shorter than them, but they didn't always understand much about the development of a child. You know, I remember my parents thinking, or probably thinking, oh, he's just a child. What difference does it make if he's, you know, watching the strippers or, you know, that kind of thing? They didn't really get what was going on under the surface. And I remember one of the comics taking me out for the day. We went on some outing in some city that we were playing. I don't know what city it was. And I remember him doing... I don't remember exactly what he said, but I got the impression that he was doing very bawdy jokes with me. And then he looked at me at one point and said, "You really know what I'm saying, don't you?" And I didn't. But, but they really didn't know what was going on in the head of a little kid. You know, I mean, it really was one of the troupe.
Hmm. You also see the world at this point in time as one in which there is the world of entertainment and entertainers. And then there is this, as you call it, the civilian world.
Yeah.
I mean, civilians who were not part of entertainment, I suppose people who were out in the audience. First of all, I'm curious, I don't remember if you say this, is that a term which everybody was using, or is that a term which you sort of utilized yourself to make sense of that?
No, that's an inside word. I think still in the theater it's used. The idea is that somehow that, you know, this traveling band of actors are this special group, and they come into a town, and they always have some inside knowledge. They're going to put on a show and make an entertainment out of nothing, and the people who come are the civilians, the regular citizens. They're not part of this brotherhood. There's a lot in that word, and it's partly meant as a joke, and it's partly meant as perhaps a reaction to the fact that actors, especially traveling bands of actors, for centuries were never regarded very highly. They were a step up from vagabonds, and not such a big step. So it was probably a way for them to feel special, that they were this group with a secret knowledge, and the others didn't have it, and they were the civilians. But I took that in my need to be special. I really did believe for a while that, you know, as a child, that because I belonged to that world, I was special. I was different from the audience. And I had, one of the things that I had to learn through my life was that I was a civilian, and I had to learn how I thought and behaved as a civilian, as one of the people in the audience, or I'd never be able to really bring any kind of art to them that they would understand, that they would share in. To use them as an audience, to get them to laugh, to get them to respond and buy tickets, you can do that just by sheer performing. But if you want to be some kind of artist, then you have to understand your own humanity, I think.
Hmm.
And that's really what the book is about, is me trying to learn how to become a human.
We're speaking with Alan Alda about his memoir, Never Have Your Dog Stuffed and Other Things I've Learned. When you talk about your school years, there's all kinds of interesting things there, including lots of encounters with bullies and your own sort of turbulent relationship with schooling and so on. A couple of things really stand out, and one of them is actually a brief little experience, but it obviously was important enough that you mention it and describe it so movingly. An encounter at a Catholic school with someone named Brother Jacob. And a brief encounter you have with him in which involving the photography club and a way in which you end up feeling, you say, doubly betrayed. I wonder if you would just share that.
Well, I didn't recognize it at first when you said it, because Brother Jacob is a name I made up. I couldn't remember his real name, but if there are any real Brother Jacobs out there, I don't mean you, probably.
Mm-hmm.
But this was a guy who ran the photography club, and... although he was a man of the cloth, he was really interested in getting these high school students, these boys, into the dark room where he could take liberties with them. And I didn't know that. And I loved photography, and I had spent many hours in the dark room as a kid learning to develop and print my own pictures. And I loved making pictures. And so when I saw there was a contest in the school, I entered a picture in the contest, and I see him at the end of the hall one day, and he throws out his arms and he says, "You won! You won the contest." And I thought, "Well, gee, that's terrific!" And all of a sudden, he's hugging me, and his arms are like iron around me, and he's making contact with his whole body in a way that it would not call appropriate. And I thought, "Well, geez, I gotta get out of this grip of this guy."
You said this is suddenly not flattering anymore.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It had gone from photography to something else. So later, the other boys were laughing at me like I should have known this. And they said, "That's the way he operates. He gets you in the dark room, and then that's it." So I really did feel betrayed in two ways. First of all, the physical contact he was trying to make with me was a betrayal of a teacher-student relationship. And secondly, that he had, I guess, pretended to like my pictures so he could put me in that compromising position. And I felt those two distinct betrayals. And I think the one I felt the worst was that the innocence of giving him a picture that I cared about and that he pretended to like hurt even more. That innocence was betrayed.
Well, and whenever this occurs, and not just with priests, but with any kind of trusted mentor figure who engages in this, I mean, it's almost always the same kind of double betrayal. You say it was a double betrayal. It wasn't just the creepy physical advance he'd made. It was also the disregard for the work I had done.
Yeah.
I mean, that speaks to something that we don't stop to think about. I mean, another layer of pain.
When you have sexual harassment in the office, I think when we read about it, we often think of it as only one layer of bad behavior. But it's not only the inappropriate advance. It's what about, am I of no value to you in the work I do, that you can disregard it in such a way, or that you can use it to get me in the position you want. And that's a double betrayal. Mm.
A much happier experience for you towards the end of your schooling is when you are able to head off to Paris. And I think it's actually, though, just ahead of that, that you sit down with a number of the brothers of this school.
Oh, this was in college, I think. Yeah, this was when I was in... go ahead. I'm sorry I'm interrupting you.
No, that's fine. I mean, I might be kind of throwing things together here, but it's a situation where you are gathering to talk about Greek comedies.
Mm, yeah.
And you begin very fearful, because here you are, the only student in this room, and this very learned sort of discussion is taking place. And then slowly but surely you begin to realize, I know about this. I know this. I know what they're talking about. You're actually able to offer your own observations and so on. And we realize that this is one of the pinnacle moments for you in a life full of wanting to know more, to discover new ideas and so on. And we realize as we read this what a delicious feeling it is to realize that you have learned something you didn't know before.
Right. I didn't realize how much I had learned. It was a scene that took place in college. I was about to go study in France, spend my junior year in France studying. And so the Honors Society asked me in for this evening to be part of the discussion. And I read the play forget which Greek comedy it was, but everybody had read it in the original Greek, and I really felt out of it. I thought, how am I going to keep up with this conversation? And then I realized that this bawdy entertainment that was the Greek comedy, and they were very bawdy, was very much like what I had seen the comics do in burlesque. And I realized that I had experienced the tradition that was identical to the tradition that came out of Greek comedy, but I had seen it in person, and they had only read it in Greek, you know. And I could add something to the conversation that was, in fact, useful and interesting. And it made me feel like $1 million that I had learned more than I thought I had, even though I hadn't had as much or the same kind of formal education that some of my colleagues had.
Hmm. Speaking of delicious pinnacles for you, one of your first great experiences after school, after you've married and are kind of trying to build yourself a career, is when you put together some sketches for an off-Broadway review. Yeah. You talk about standing in the wings at the first preview and watching that first sketch that you had written. You hear laughter in the audience. You say, this was the first time I had heard an audience laugh at something I had written. And a cocktail of sweet, tingling hormones shot through my brain. I was suddenly aware of what an astonishing power there was in words.
Yeah, it's a wonderful feeling. And you only get that, I think, or you get it most vividly if you write something that an audience will respond to vocally. You also get it when you write it down and people read it, but you get it translated later. It's through time. When it's on the stage, it's immediate, and your response really is much more palpable. It really encouraged me to keep writing.
That is the much honored actor Alan Alda, and the occasion of our conversation way back in 2005 was the publication of his marvelous memoir called Never Have Your Dog Stuffed and Other Things I've Learned, published by Random House. The very specific occasion of our conversation was Alan Alda's visit to Alverno College to speak there as part of a special lecture series. It's 8:47, and to finish out today's program, I want to play for you conversation with another notable man of comedy, namely Bob Newhart. This conversation from 2006 was done just after the publication of his memoir called I Shouldn't Even Be Doing This and Other Things That Strike Me as Funny, published by Hachette. WGTD is actually located right between Milwaukee and Chicago, so our listeners are especially interested to hear all that you have to say about the wonderful city of Chicago, with whom you have such a close relationship. One thing in particular I think is especially interesting is when you say something about Chicago audiences. You say Chicago audiences just can't be fooled by a stand-up comic. In other cities, people sort of laugh where they're supposed to laugh, but people in Chicago only laugh when something is funny. Any idea why that is, and also how you've experienced that yourself?
I don't know why it is. I just know it is. I know that you can't fool a Midwest audience as you can fool other audiences, say a San Francisco or New York audience, because there are certain buzzwords that, like Kafka, you know. If you can work Kafka into it, you generally, a New York audience will laugh. And also putting on airs. People always say, well, you seem like pretty much like you were, you know, when you first started out. And I said, well, we have this thing in the Midwest about putting on airs, you know, and don't act like something you're not, you know.
So you think that's part of why you've sort of stayed so true to yourself, that because Chicago audiences just wouldn't have tolerated much of anything else?
Well, that, and I had a wife who kept me grounded and never let me really get too full of myself.
Very good. I know the feeling. you have also, among other things, given some of the credit for your particular wonderful, refreshing brand of comedy to some of the work which you did in law school, and in particular, an appreciation for the precise word. Tell us a little more about that.
Well, for instance, in the best example I can think of in a routine, which is one of the original routines that I started out with, the submarine commander, and it's a routine on a man who, especially in service or in a large corporation, it's an example of the Peter principle. He is advanced fully two or three levels beyond his competency, and he's in charge of the submarine, and he's recalling for the crew this memorable trip that they're just ending, and he's congratulating them on the 2 minutes that they just cut off the record for surfacing, firing at the towed target, and then resubmerging, and he's congratulating them. It's a new record. They took 2 minutes off the previous record. And he said at the same time, I don't slight in any way the contribution made by the men we had to leave on deck. I think they had a lot to do with the 2 minutes we were able to cut off the record. And I doubt if any of us will soon forget their somewhat stunned expressions as we watched them through the periscope. So I think slight is just the right word, and stunned expressions is just the right word for. I think I took that with me from law school. It's one of the few things I ever took from law school.
Well, we're glad that you did. You also talk about how comedians have to be at heart anti-authority, subversive in some sort of way. It's interesting for you to say that because, of course, those probably aren't the first couple of terms which most people would gravitate towards in trying to describe you or your brand of comedy. I mean, other people have been more obviously subversive. In what way has the work you've done been subversive in the way you're talking about?
Well, it's in there. It's very subtle, but it's in there. For instance, when I did the retirement party, and that was really based on my experience when I was an accountant, and I worked for an insurance company, and because someone I first did that, and someone wrote me a letter, and they said, they were offended that I was making fun of Charlie Bedloe, who was receiving the watch after 50 years with the company, and who was he was blotto all the time, and I wrote back and explained to him that I wasn't making fun of Charlie. I was making fun of the system that made him get blotto every day, to get through the day. That's the only way he could get through the day. And again, in the submarine commander, it's making fun of the large corporation or the military, and then Abe Lincoln, of course, is making fun of a revered former president. So there is that element. It may be understated, but it's in. I think it's in almost every routine.
We're speaking with Bob Newhart about his wonderful new memoir called "I Shouldn't Even Be Doing This" and other things that strike me as funny. You talk about how, especially in the first years of your career, you were writing almost all of your material in a vacuum, not really knowing if it was ever going to be performed. Do you think that was a helpful thing in a sense, that you were writing it in that way? Did it give you maybe a certain sort of a freedom?
Yeah, I suppose it was, Greg. It was... Ed Gallagher and I had a syndicated radio program, which was eminently unsuccessful. We finally wound up costing us money to do it, and then Ed got an offer for a job in New York. So I was kind of on my own. Either I had to find another partner or do it as a single. And even though I had no outlet for it, I would see something and it would strike me funny. And I had to write it down. I had to get it down on paper before I forgot it. Even though I never knew where I was going to ever have a chance to perform it.
Hmm. those routines, some of them at least, came to light and were shared on PBS in the wonderful American Masters special they did about you. That must have really felt pretty cool, that a show that devotes itself to people like Leonard Bernstein devoted its resources to celebrating you and your career.
Exactly, and it was. And I don't know that it was so much a salute to me as it was a salute to the role of comedy and the role that comedy plays in our lives, and how important comedy is to our lives.
Absolutely, you talk in wonderful detail in your memoir about that marvelous show which debuted in the 1970s, which so many of us enjoyed and have practically memorized word for word. I especially liked one thing you said about the way that your marriage with Emily was crafted in the Bob Newhart show. You said there was the perfect amount of tension, love, and respect to make that marriage feel real. We read those words and we realize so seldom is that balance correctly achieved elsewhere.
That pretty accurately describes the relationship that Emily and I had, and we had respect for each other, and she was independent, but at the same time dependent in a way on me and me on her.
Hmm. You say that in that show it's 85% the real Bob and 15% is TV Bob. In other words, we're mostly seeing you. Most of the time when we've seen you on television and film, is that about the right proportion?
Yes. My wife has always said, if the American public ever found out what you were really like, they would never show up. And of course, my response was, we're going to keep that secret, aren't we? if we want to keep living the way that we're living. So,
very good.
I tend to find humor in the... I tend to deal with misfortune humorously.
You also touch at one point about how one of the costs of fame is that you're not necessarily out and about in the grocery store aisles and so on like you once were. And of course, it's those real-life encounters which generated so much of your material.
Yeah, in a way, your success, which we're all trying to achieve, it kind of cuts you off from the source of your material. And it means you just have to work a little harder at developing your material and finding it.
Well, you seem to manage to do that. Of course, your later career has also included some dramatic acting, that marvelous run on ER, for instance. Do you hope to do more of that?
Yeah, I would love to, given the right script. And I was highly complimented that John Wells thought that I was up to that role. I always call that my first intentionally dramatic role. there have been other comedic roles I played that turned out to be tragic. That was the first intentionally dramatic role, and not really based on what he had seen me do, but he just felt I could handle it, and I felt very complimented, and the writing was marvelous.
Well, and the folks who nominated you for an Emmy apparently thought you did a good job as well.
Yeah, apparently.
Very good. For all that you've given the American public, we thank you, and I thank you for writing this wonderful book. I shouldn't even be doing this. A pleasure to speak with you, Mr. Bob Newhart.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you very much.